It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
We own this country. We own it. And it's not you owning it and not politicians owning it. Politicians are employees of ours. And they're just going to come around and beg for votes every few years, and it's the same old deal. But I just think that it's important that you realize that whether you're Democrat or whether you're a Republican or whether you're Libertarian or whatever, when somebody does not do the job, we've got to let them go.
When your entire culture is under attack, you need the country's number one voice in defense of our American way of life. You need an ally in the fight against tyranny and corruption. You need your weekly dose of Lisa Payne Nager. Missouri Grassroots Radio Network proudly adds our own beauty to America the Beautiful, your own culture vigilante, Ms. Lisa Payne Nager.
Welcome back to Missouri Grassroots Radio. This is Lisa Payne Nager. You're listening to Culture Vigilante. It's been a couple of weeks since I've been on air with you. I'm glad to be back. A lot has been going on in the last couple of weeks. I don't know about you, but I'm madder than a wet hen over the things that I'm seeing going on in the country over the last couple of weeks. And right, you know, prior to Independence Day, as we're all getting ready to celebrate the 4th of July and our nation's independence, I think I said this last year, but this may be the last year that we will be celebrating our independence, if Barack Obama has anything to do with it. On the line with me tonight, I'm happy to have with me again to help me open the show is Owen Schroyer of KFXN 1380 Radio, and Owen's always on top of these things. Thanks for popping in with me tonight, Owen.
Hey, my pleasure. Great opening, by the way. We should all be mad and we should all really embrace, you know, Independence Day, because who knows, it really could be the last.
Yeah, I mean, I've kind of thought that the last couple of years. I didn't think last year, I mean, really, I was, you know, worried about it, but I didn't think that we could possibly be in this kind of shape, the shape that we're in this year, looking at the things that we're looking at, staring right down the nose at. It's just that it's amazing. So I'm guessing, Owen, you've been all over these SCOTUS rulings and immigration stuff that's been going on, the hot stuff in the news the last couple of weeks. What have you been noticing that's been going on? What did you think of the SCOTUS?
Well, to be honest with you, I haven't been following the SCOTUS as much. I do realize, though, the basic things on the surface, such as a 9-0 ruling against Obama, yeah, is key. And people need to realize that just on a very, very superficial level, that a 9-0 against Obama really says a lot about where this country is at right now. And unfortunately, of course, the mainstream dinosaur dead media is not going to cover it the way it should be. But that's kind of the way I really wrap up the whole SCOTUS thing. The immigration thing is more important to me, or at least I've been following it more. And you open the show with how we should be mad. Well, look, we can be mad over a lot of things, but this is something very basic and fundamental that makes me mad. You know, I'm a student in this great nation, and like many of us students were led to believe, we had to go into debt to get a higher education and get a job. Well, beyond the delusion of that, just the fact now that we have immigrants coming into this country illegally, and not only are they being treated with a doctor when they get here, not only are they receiving new clothes, 6X underwear, hundreds of pairs of 6X underwear. You think I'm joking. Look that up. They get food. They get shelter. And here I am, an American citizen, going into debt. More than half of kids my age going into debt before we're even 20 years old. I mean, that is just fundamentally terribly wrong, and I'm getting mad now just talking about it.
Well, you know, I often wonder about you young kids, you know, students. When I was a student, you could get a bachelor's degree for $5,000, you know, which was a lot of money back then still, but you could go into debt for $5,000 and you could reasonably work, you could expect to reasonably work your way out of your grad, you know, your undergraduate degree. You can't do that now. And I can't even imagine what it's like for a young person like you, you know, taking on these kinds of expenses, looking at this. I mean, you know, you guys are going to be spending more on your education than I spent on my first house.
Well, there's a lot of things that I believe can be done to rectify this issue. I'm always a big fan of voting with your dollar, and this will never happen. But, hey, kids, stop going to college. Boycott the system. What are they going to do? They're either going to have to lower prices or higher education will have to be reset. I don't even think that higher education is all that it's worked up to be. Obviously, if you want to be a doctor or an architect, an engineer,
right,
certain things like that, you obviously need higher education, and there's things that you can only learn in college. But I can tell you, most of the jobs out there, you learn from experience, on hand, for free, or getting paid. You're way better off at this point not going into debt. Now, if you're fortunate and your parents are willing to pay for all of your college, then obviously that would be a great idea for you to do. But not that many people are that fortunate. And as you talked about, you can't even, you're not even guaranteed a job when you get out of school anymore. I mean, you talk about, you know, going into debt $5,000 but being able to pay that when you get out of college. Well, that's because it was a lot easier to get a job. I mean, I remember talking to my dad. We recently went on a road trip together, and we were talking about our lives in our early 20s, you know, after college and stuff. And he was talking about how he could have – he basically just went around to, like, four different jobs before he was even 24, because when you had a degree, you could just go to a business, and a lot of businesses would hire you. That's not even close to the case these days. So, I mean, that's just a whole other issue. But, again – and then I have to turn around and watch illegal immigrants pouring into this country, getting tuition to go to college. Some community colleges just give free education to illegal immigrants now. It makes me madder than a hornet.
Yeah, I can't even imagine. We're going to talk about some of that illegal immigration stuff a little bit later on in the show. We've been covering a lot of this, a lot of Department of Family Services issue, and Paul Ellison is going to come on with us a little bit later in the show. We've been kind of talking about the issues related to the to how American families are being torn apart by the judicial system, not only in Missouri but across the country, and how good parents are being separated from their children by the judicial system, follow the money. And what occurs to me is with all of these illegal immigrants coming across the country and these people dumping their kids off at the border, 52,000 kids since October have been shuttled into this country without parents, just dropped off at the border. Now you tell me, if a parent in the United States did that to their child, shuffled their kid off somewhere, trying to pawn their kids off to somewhere where they thought that, you know, would somebody would take better care of them, they didn't want to take care of their kids anymore, or they were trying to find a better, you know, just dumping their kids somewhere, we would be hauled off to jail. But now those illegal immigrants who are dumping their kids off at the border of the United States and have and assuming that our tax dollars and our programs are going to take care of those kids are coming across the border again to reclaim those kids, and they're giving their kids back. What is that all about? And how does that double standard work here in the United States?
Well, I mean, I don't know where I get started with the double standards just surrounding this whole deal. I think I just touched one of them with the college, you know, students in America and then the illegal immigrants getting education. But what's happening here, too, is that we have to realize is obviously the numbers pouring in are almost, I mean, they are unbelievable. It's like unquantifiable how unbelievable they are. And a lot. And so what happens is they come in and they get a citation. They don't get taken back to the border.
No.
They literally are getting paid. They literally get a paid bus fare or a paid train fare, wherever they want, from DHS to go where they might have family members or friends who have also made it across the border. I mean, people think this is a joke. They're admitting they're doing it. Border Patrol agents are all on record with this stuff. I mean, what the hell is that? I never heard of such madness. I mean, seriously, you can't write this stuff up. And the double standard, I mean, again, where do you begin? The parents that are abandoning these kids, but then guess what? They come over here, they say 90% of them don't show up to their court date. So that's 90% of what? How many people will come over here? 100,000? So that's 90,000 who won't show up in court and will just stay here. Keep in mind, a lot of these people are going to have babies. Now that baby's going to be an American citizen. What do you do then? I mean, this whole thing is a mess. And it's a voter bloc that's uneducated, and they're being fed formula by the DHS. I mean, this is just disgusting, Lisa. I don't know where to stop.
Yeah, well, there is nowhere to stop. I mean, it just gets worse and worse all the time. And then, you know, not to take your eye off the ball, you know, with all the other issues going on in the Middle East, the first thing Obama does is he throws another shiny object into the mix to divert your attention, and they're going to push through the amnesty issue, and they're going to use all of these kids being pushed across the border as the reason to get amnesty put through.
It's funny how they always use the kids, how they always use our basic emotions, our very human emotions against us to get some of this legislation passed that they want. I mean, every time there's a school shooting, they milk that to death to get any legislation they possibly can. You know, it's always for the kids. Well, you know, if these really cared about the kids, well, A, they wouldn't be trying to push Common Core, but B, they wouldn't be doing this to our country. I mean, it is a joke how badly these people are wrecking the country, but then they want to pose like they're doing it because they care about the kids? Give me a break. I'm not buying that for a second, and I can't believe anyone who still is.
Well, that, you know, in my experience, Owen, it's not just the federal government that's doing this. People have been using kids as human shields for decades. I even on the most local level of your government, I sat on a school board for 3 years out here in St. Charles County, and it is shameful the way they use kids to play on people's sympathies. And the average John Q. and Joan Q. public, they believe that people are working in the best interest of the kids. And, you know, again, and I we'll bring this up when Paul Ellison comes on, but even the courts, people think that judges and Department of Family Services and all of these bureaucratic entities that are part of our, you know, mainstream part of our government now, they all think that those folks are working in the best interest of the kids, and they're not. When government gets to be a certain size, it becomes about the money. And in almost every single case, whether it's the teachers union, whether it's in the judiciary, whether it's in the federal government, when people are using kids as human shields, you can find out what the reasoning is if you follow the money trail, almost always.
Well, follow the money, that's always a great way to start. I mean, just look at, but you somehow, Lisa, Hillary Clinton was dead broke when she left the White House.
Yeah, well, yeah. I'd like to live with Hillary's example of dead broke for just a year of my life.
Right, that's what I was saying. If I had $1 million, which Hillary had plenty of, she had a few million when she left the White House, I would retire. She called that dead broke? These are the people that we call our leaders? She's not leading me anywhere.
If there are any publishers out there listening to the show tonight, I am available for good book signing deals. I will sign a good book signing deal anytime. So just contact me here at Missouri Grassroots Coalition. I'd be happy to follow Hillary on the speaker circuit. Just, you know, give me a call. I'm ready.
Yeah, and hey, I've actually known you to be quite an honest person. So that might be, maybe they want to change the pace there a little bit.
Yeah, I don't know.
I know that's not part of the course, but come on.
Yep. So, Owen, what's going on your show there on KXFN these days? I heard that you have switched your time.
Yes, we are now 10 to midnight, Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, Friday. And then on Wednesday night, what we do is an uncensored version, because what I found is I can't really hold my tongue, so we do an FCC version just on the Internet. Wednesday night starts at 10. usually goes for about an hour, hour and a half. And there's also going to be a name change. It's going to be called Media Unchained, because I believe that the media people are being fed right now is totally chained down by the establishment. A lot of it state-run. Just look at MSNBC, a perfect example. So I think name kind of better quantifies what I'm trying to do with my show for 2 hours a night. So Media Unchained, we're not politically correct, and the only slant and bias we have is liberty, love, Constitution, peace, and the truth.
Absolutely. Sounds wonderful. And, folks, if you want to get a taste of Owen Schroyer and his previous Nuclear Fire, you can Google Nuclear Fire. He's got a whole set of great YouTube videos of the full shows previous to date, and I'm sure he'll have one for the next couple of weeks. I'll be joining him tomorrow evening at 10 o'clock on KXFN 1380. You can stream it. You can watch the podcast on the Internet. Any other way to find you, Owen?
The best way is either on the app 1380 The X, or just plug my name into a Google search, Owen Schroyer. That's usually the best way. All the material is there.
Awesome. Thanks for joining me tonight, Owen. And we'll be talking to you very soon. And hang in there. It'll be okay. How are you going to celebrate your fourth?
I haven't decided yet. I just had a long weekend for my birthday, so I'm still kind of recuperating from some sunburns from the lake. But, it's always a pleasure to come on your show. I appreciate what you're doing. Keep fighting the good fight. And hopefully someday, you know, we will be the real media and we'll replace the dead media that the zombies continue to watch every night.
I'm right there along with you. Thank you. And very happy birthday to you, young man.
Thank you. Thank you. We'll talk to you soon.
Okay. Folks, bye-bye. We've got a great show lined up for you tonight. When I put the blog teaser out, we do have an interview with Dwayne Weed. We've got some prepping info, but due to technical difficulties on my end, I was not able to upload that interview, but I will have that interview for you next week. And in its place, we're going to replay an interview that we did last year with Bill Federer. You know, Bill Federer is just awesome. You know, listen to that man talk. You can just listen to him talk for days and days and days. Great American history interview with him that we did this time last year, right before the 4th of July. So we'll play that tonight in place of the Dwayne Weed interview, which we will play in its entirety next week. But coming up, speaking of your liberties, folks, We've got an issue here in St. Charles County, and it's not unlike issues that are going on all across the state of Missouri and all across the country, actually. There is an attack on your constitutional liberties via your local sheriff. Sheriff's departments across the country are disappearing left and right. And if you followed us very closely here when we covered the Bundy issue, you should know that kind of thing is why you need your local sheriff. We're going to get into that in depth tonight on how we're going to fight to maintain our local sheriff's department here in St. Charles County and across the country. We've got Tony Tawa and Dave Warner, who's actually a candidate for sheriff here in St. Charles County, talking about the very importance of that issue, giving us all the details of why you really do need to maintain your constitutional sheriff in your country. And we're going to talk to Paul Ellison. He's got some updates on yet other cases in Camden County in the state of Missouri where the DFS folks are overstepping their bounds and, you know, child abuse is resulting from the local judiciary and the local government in that area where kids are just falling through the cracks. So stay with us, folks. We've got a great show for you lined up tonight. Thanks for being with me here tonight on Culture Vigilante, Missouri Grassroots Radio. We'll be right back after this message.
It really is time for the people of America to take up pitchforks.
No matter what time of year it is, it's never too early to start preparing for the holidays. And here at Missouri Grassroots Coalition, we're thinking of Christmas now. Why? Because we've set an ambitious goal for ourselves to raise $2,000. That's right, we want to raise $2,000 in 2013 to help some Missouri families who may be struggling in this Obama economy to provide a magical Christmas morning for their children. Last year, in 2012, Missouri Grassroots Coalition touched the lives of 15 families because of the generosity of conservatives across the state who provided us with the means to pay off their layaway accounts on Christmas Eve. This year, we'd like to be able to help twice that number of families, and we're asking you to help us with that goal. Please go to MissouriGrassrootsCoalition.org and click on the Secret Santa tab. All the details are there for you to send us what you can by PayPal, check, or money order. We want to thank all who contributed last year for their generosity and hope that you will all help us continue to prove that charitable giving works best in a constitutional republic.
So dear, for peace so sweet, as to be purchased at the price of chains and slavery. Forbid it, Almighty God. I know not what course others may take, but as for me, give me liberty or give me death.
We're back. This is Culture Vigilante. You're listening to Lisa Payne Nager on Missouri Grassroots Radio. I hope I'm not beginning to sound like a broken record, folks, but I mean, there just really is no more important issue than for folks to start getting engaged. If you're not engaged, I know a lot of this listening audience is very engaged in their constitutional liberties and their principles. You know, we need to start reaching out to the outlying community, because trying to fight these issues on our own, we're losing the battle. And here, St. Charles County is the poster child for what's going wrong with this particular issue. We have a county executive here who is a Republican. I say that, you know, air quotes, Republican. You know, St. Charles County, Missouri is one of the reddest counties in the state, but it is full of rhino Republicans. And these people are power hungry, you know, just like any progressive that you would meet. These folks are more interested in maintaining their power than they are really trying to turn the country around and keep it nailed down to constitutional principles. I sat in a Packeter meeting a week ago, where, since we're coming up on primary elections here in Missouri in August, we were interviewing several of the county council members. And, you know, all of the county council members during that interview but one were very progressive. They you know, didn't have a problem with certain Agenda 21 issues. They didn't have a problem with losing our county sheriff's department. They didn't have a problem. We had a big stink about a year ago about we can't buy over-the-counter pseudoephedrine anymore. I mean, there are just so many things that these folks just don't seem to have a problem with taking our personal liberties away. They want to initiate smoking bans on businesses in the community. You know, they're just sticking their nose into places where they just don't belong. You know, I guess they have nothing better to do, but they just don't belong. And in November 2012, at the last minute, the county council put an initiative on the ballot, and it was very craftily worded to where people didn't really know what they were voting for. And what it effectively did was it took most of the responsibility and the duty away from our county sheriff and shifted it to a county executive appointed police chief. We're going to have a county police force now, unless we can turn this baby around real quick, and who will answer only to the person who appointed him, the county executive. And with me tonight, I have two gentlemen that are going to give us the fine points and the details about why this is important to you. You know, you may not live in Missouri. Even if you don't live in Missouri, this kind of thing is not just happening here in our state. It's happening all across the country, in counties all across the country and in every state. Tony Tawa and Dave Warner are here with me. Both of these gentlemen are deeply embedded in the St. Charles County Sheriff's Initiative, and they are working very closely on one level or another to try to turn this issue around. Tony is very, very informed and involved in trying to get this initiative put back on the ballot in August so that we can vote on this again, so have some time to educate our voters. And Dave Warner is a candidate for sheriff, one of several, who is trying to run for sheriff and is very also involved and supports the County Sheriff's Preservation Act. Thank you, gentlemen, for being with me tonight.
Thank you for having us on. Appreciate the opportunity.
Okay, let's start with you, Tony. Give me some info. Let's kind of just do the background on this whole Sheriff's Initiative. Kind of give me the real quick and dirty about how it came about. I kind of outlined it a little bit. And then let's talk about why, you know, people just really don't understand why this is an egregious abridgment of our liberties.
Okay, well, as you kind of set the table, really it all started 2 years ago when at the last moment the county council put that confusingly worded question on the ballot that passed by less than 1%, which, unless it's overturned this year, calls for the January 2015 creation of a county police department. The St. Charles County Liberty Project and a number of deputies worked hard against the effort in 2012 in the very few weeks we had, but we fell a little bit short. Then about under a year ago, the St. Charles County Liberty Project decided to try and put an initiative petition effort together. And I think it was slow getting off the ground. I think people felt like they had all the time in the world to get this thing done. And, you know, as human nature felt like, oh, we got plenty of time, let the other guy do it, you know.
Sure.
So
well, it's not
it's
a small task. How many signatures do you need to be able to get? I mean, that's a big deal.
Right.
How many?
Officially, we need the law is that you need 10% in each of the 7 council districts of the number of votes that were cast for governor in the previous election. What that works out to countywide is 16,200 and change. Our goal, though, is to get about 18,500, so we have like a 10% margin. Those are the numbers that we're going after. I have to admit that through the first, 10 months of the effort, it was basically 3 or 4 people trying to shoulder the load. One person that you had on a couple months ago, Mark Mesmer,
passed away.
Right. Yeah. He was a key player in the effort, and he through his efforts, he recently, you know, prior to his passing, recruited a large contingent of people, a fairly committed contingent of people from the Oath Keepers that have helped out recently. And they're doing a great job collecting signatures. Just last week I got 21 sheets from them and then another 32 from some of them and from some others on Sunday. So in the past week, over 50 sheets came in. So it is ramping up, and that's due to, I'd say, really at least 3 factors. One, the fact that the Oath Keepers and others have become involved and some of the deputies realizing, hey, this deadline's getting close, let's do something. So there's that procrastination element has disappeared. A second aspect was Jerry Zare and who knows something about websites got involved, so we've been able to have a more a live website than we had for the first 10 months where it was basically static, because myself and Mark Mesmer and, like I said, the couple other individuals that were carrying the load weren't really tech savvy. So now we do have a decent website to help communication efforts and coordination efforts. And finally, the county council did something that actually helped our effort. When on April 28th, they decided to acquire an MRAP, which is one of those armed personnel areas that, you know, that belong in Fallujah rather than in O'Fallon.
Yeah.
So that's gotten some people realizing, hey, this is the kind of vision that the county council and county executive and Captain Todd have for the county police department, is, you know, one that's designed basically to carry out law enforcement more through, hey, you will do what we say, rather than looking at it as, you know, we're all together trying to make sure the streets are safe and citizens' rights are protected. So those three factors have breathed new life into the effort. So that's the plus. The minus is we've only got a little over a month left to collect signatures.
Yeah, and I know there are quite a few people who are motivated to get this done. This is a good time of year to get it done. There are a lot of festivals and things that will, you know, you'll be seeing folks with clipboards asking you to sign on to the initiative over the next few days, actually. But you know, it's a huge initiative to get, you know, close to 20,000 signatures, you know, just approaching people within the county. What's the reaction that you're getting from folks, you know, when you do approach these folks, you know, to trying to educate them on what's been happening in the past and what needs to happen in the future? What's your reaction from them?
The reaction is generally positive from most people. I've personally, since I've been at this since the beginning, I've personally collected over 2,200 signatures myself, 2,200 good signatures, which means approximately, as a rule of thumb, for every 25 signatures, which is a petition sheet that you collect, 20 mm-hmm. will be what I'll call good, which, in other words, the director of elections is likely to say, yeah, that signature line is valid. Probably
right.
20% are poor. So what I have found in collecting those signatures is people are generally very receptive if they know about the issue, and if they don't know about the issue, still, for the most part, they're glad you're out there doing something.
Mm-hmm.
Even though I'm not a veteran, I guess that when I'm out there collecting signatures, I kind of, I guess, get a little bit of a feeling of pride that veterans must feel for their service. You know, when voters, you know, I mean, when people sign the petition and say, thank you for what you're doing, it's a good feeling to get that positive reinforcement. I will say this. I don't know if you... let me say it now. And if I say it again later, so be it. One thing that is very useful in collecting signatures, you'll find that maybe 30 to 40% of the people that you approach, they're hesitant. They say, well, I just don't know enough about the issue. You know, I like to know more before I sign anything.
Sure.
And what I have found is really they're looking for an excuse. A lot of them are just looking for an excuse, one more, reason to sign. And when you tell them that if you don't sign the petition, that in effect is making a decision, because it allows what the county council wanted to occur, so nobody gets a choice. Whereas if you sign the petition and we're able to get it on the ballot, then you and every other voter in St. Charles County gets to make a decision, and it gives you, you know, several months to learn about the issue. I find that approximately 40 to 50% of those that are initially hesitant to sign because they don't want to, quote, do the wrong thing, at that point decide to sign. So anybody
Excellent.
That's collecting signatures, that's something useful to keep in mind.
Yeah, and it is important for folks to know this is just a ballot initiative. This is a petition initiative to get an issue put back on the ballot, because the last time it was on the ballot, they threw it up at the very last minute. The ballot language was, how do I say this in a nice way? A bunch of BS. Yes, deceiving. It was not honest to what was really happening, so people did not really understand what they were voting for, and there was not enough time for folks to get educated on the reality of what was really going on here. So just if you're out there listening and you're trying to educate yourself about this, we're just putting it on the ballot. It does not turn the situation around. It gives you the opportunity to vote on it again. So let's move to Dave. Go ahead.
Lisa, just one more thing I'd like to add, that you asked about, that it seemed a little bit daunting in terms of the numbers that we need. At times I feel like, we need to get so many more signatures, but then on the other hand, it seems so doable when I look at it a different way. I was at Irish Fest on a Friday evening and collected over 80 signatures in just over 3 hours, of which 65 turned out to be valid. And I realized at that point how close we are to achieving it. Because think about it, 65 signatures in 3 hours. Okay, most people that came out for the caucus, let's say they packed the gymnasium, and then at the do-over, even just for the winning candidate, which was Ron Paul, there were over 400 people there. Even if half of those people spent half the amount of time that they were at that caucus that one night, that effort alone gets us all the signatures we need. 200 people times 65 signatures puts us over the top. So, I mean, when you look at it that way, aren't there 200 people that love liberty enough to put in 3 hours to collect 65 good signatures? So
and
if you look at it that way, we're really close.
Yeah, and there is a good website. What's the name of the website? We'll repeat it again later, but what's the name of the website so that people can go there and volunteer?
Sheriffpreservation.org.
Okay.
And on that website, they will find all kinds of good stuff. They'll find a tab that's basically an introductory or a homepage tab. They'll find a tab where they can learn more about the issue, just get themselves up to speed, a lot of what we've covered already, the history and so forth. There's a whole tab talking about MRAPs and just how that came about in the county and, why we need to, in addition to getting rid of the creation of a county police department, get rid of this MRAP as well, which Dave Warner, who will speak in a moment, is committed to. There's a Get Involved tab that talks about the different ways to get signatures, and I hope we can come back to that before we end this. There's a news and events page, and then there's a training toolbox that basically provides all of the resources anyone needs to just, if they wanted to just print a petition form out in their, living room and collect signatures from family and friends, they'd be able to do that. So there's all kinds of good stuff on this new website. I can't say that for the first 10 months we were in that situation, but we are now.
And if folks do not understand the importance and the reality that's going on here, where the government, both the local and national government, are truly looking to take away your liberties. Look at what happened on the Bundy Ranch just a couple of months back here, where the federal government went and invaded the Bundy Ranch on a trumped up charge. And what was supposed to happen there is the sheriff is the only entity in your county that stands between you, the citizen, and the federal government. Nothing goes on in that county without the sheriff's approval. Now, if you don't have a sheriff in your county that will stand between the federal government and the citizenry, then you have basically Steve Ellman, who thinks he's king out here, who, directs the police chief, the future police chief, who he handpicks to do whatever. And folks, we do have MRAP vehicles. Did you think that we would have an MRAP vehicle? Most counties and most counties across the country do have MRAP vehicles now in their local neighborhoods. Did you ever think that you'd have an MRAP vehicle in your neighborhood 10 years ago? I don't think so.
And on that topic, and it ties both aspects of what you just talked about, Lisa, together. Marvin Steyer, who's an O'Fallon resident, at the county council meeting where they discussed acquiring the MRAP and voted to acquire it, said he testified before the council. First of all, it says donation from the federal government. Let's be clear, there's no such thing as a freebie from the federal government. There's strings attached to everything they give, whether it's a grant or a, quote, donation. In response, Captain David Todd, who's likely to become the appointed chief of police unless, you know, we're able to prevent the creation of that department, this was his answer. And I want everybody to hear this answer loud and clear. It gives you an insight into their mindset. This was his response. As far as the strings are concerned, the only string that I'm aware of is we cannot sell it, we cannot give it away, because it belongs to the federal government. It's basically a loaner, for lack of a better term.
Oh, God,
and you can see that. You can see that testimony on the county council's website. But, you know, they have videos of every meeting. So you don't have to take my word for it. You can see it, you know, you can see him speaking those words.
Yep, they're absolutely in the tank for big government. Okay, so I want to move to Dave now. Dave Warner is is one of the several candidates for sheriff here in St. Charles County. Dave, I'm just going to kind of turn you loose here. I looked at your website a little bit. You are a very outspoken proponent of this initiative. Regardless of which way it goes in August, we will still elect a sheriff with very diminished responsibility. Tell me what motivated you to run. Well, first of all, when this initiative first came out, I mean, it's kind of scary for you guys to step out of the cover of darkness. This is your job here, you know, and you guys are all working for the current sheriff, and taking a stand on this issue is not an easy thing, you know, to come out into the light. What motivated you to do this?
Well, I'm more or less tired of Steve Ellman doing his power grab. Like I told people in my past debates, whether I win this election or not, I don't want to lose my voice. And approximately 6 or 7 years ago, Steve Ellman decided that's when he started talking about trying to, how are we going to make this a county police department?
It's been a long-term plan. This is not a surprise.
Right. And around that time, I decided, well, you know what? I'm going to finish my master's degrees. I want to have my 20-year mark of policing. And I'm going to run for sheriff. I want to change things. I'm tired of the same old boys, the good old boy system staying in there, passing their job titles on to their buddies and their cronies. As you'll see, the county is plastered with Scott Lewis posters.
He's got, a lot of money.
He's Steve Ellman's puppet, more or less. He wants to put his boy in the police department and have his boy over in the sheriff's department. That way he's complete God.
Yep, he's in complete control.
I mean, our sheriffs, we're here. It's the only elected law enforcement officers that are responsible, you know, for protection of our citizens and our counties, you know, not only against crime, but against violations of the U.S. and state constitution. You know, the sheriff is supposed to protect and defend and preserve our rights. You know, they answer to the citizens, not bow down to any federal agency that wants to walk in, and especially do not bow down to this county executive.
Okay, let me throw a question at you, the kind of devil's advocate, because I've had people contact me, you know, and this is their response to us losing our ability to vote our sheriff in and out of office. If you don't like what your sheriff is doing, you're stuck with the sheriff for 4 years, and then hopefully you can vote him out. But if you don't like what your sheriff is doing or your police chief is doing, you can always petition your county executive at any time to take care of that problem. So what say you about that?
As far as the county executive, he can't touch the sheriff. They're both elected. Realistically, if you look at it, the sheriff's the highest ranking law enforcement officer in the county.
But what about the police chief?
Police chief, he has to answer directly to your county exec.
What's the likelihood that the county executive is going to do anything to a police chief that he handpicked?
That he's appointed? Nothing. Nothing at all. You'll see plain and simple. If you get a police chief that decides to look at the good for the people and his men in that, Tim Fitch over in St. Louis County butted heads with Dooley and stuck up for some stuff that Dooley did not want him to do. Next thing you know, Tim Fitch has to retire.
Hmm.
And he was battling the corruption with Dooley there.
Right.
You know, there's a lot of things that went on behind the scenes there. Tim Fitch was an awesome chief. The guys liked him. He stuck up for the guys. You know, but that's just to show that if the county exec gets tired out here, of the police chief not bowing down to his every demand or doing his favors or doing this or doing that, he'll replace him. Nothing the citizens can say or do will be able to change that come January 1 if we don't get these signatures.
Yeah, and so if we have a situation where an MRAP vehicle is coming down my street here, you know, in my little suburban neighborhood, and I don't like it, and I call my police chief, and he sticks up for me, and he does the right thing, and then all of a sudden, you know, Steve Ellman doesn't like it, or, you know, could happen in your neighborhood too.
Right,
and your county executive doesn't like it.
We don't have a place for them here in St. Charles County. We don't see the crime rate that Chicago or New York City has. Do they need them up there? Probably. Do we need them here? No way.
Yeah,
we
have SWAT teams. We have sophisticated police.
Yes, our guys here are very well trained and very well equipped. They don't need this other stuff. It's just toys for certain individuals to say, "Hey, look what I got."
Yeah. Exactly. We have a little ballot initiative. We're going to talk about it in coming shows, a little ballot initiative that, I mean, folks, you know, the Right to Farm Bill. You know, when the government at a state level or a local level is looking to take away your small little liberties, whether or not you can raise rabbits in your backyard or grow tomatoes or, you know, when they pick the winners and losers and decide who's going to do what, your county sheriff, you still need your county sheriff for those things. To be able to stand up for you and your liberties.
And to make that point, Lisa, I mean, a lot of people don't realize it, but the sheriff's the highest ranking law officer in the county. There's no federal agent or director that outranks him. If a
exactly.
Fed tries to push him around or override him, the sheriff can outrule him and have him arrested. You know, and these people don't realize this, the power that the sheriff has here to stand up for us. A police chief, you have a federal boy walk in there, that police chief's going to bow to him and call the county exec.
Exactly.
To do what they want. Your sheriff, he can say, get out.
Well, Dave, you have a number of years of experience in law enforcement, and you've been a deputy in this county for how long?
Well, I've never worked in St. Charles County. All my experience has been in St. Louis County.
Okay.
I've lived out here in St. Charles County and since 95. I have many friends and family that work for the sheriff's department. And I've seen the system way too well, how if the county exec or certain
yeah.
person don't like them, how they get reprimanded for stuff. But if they're in the club, you know, same thing can be done. Nothing happens to them.
Everything's
good. It's kind of changed all that.
Okay. Well, we're getting down to the wire. The primary is the first Tuesday in August. We're just a few weeks away. How can people get involved in your campaign, Dave?
We ask them to come out and help us with the initiative. I got my people now when we're out putting up signs, handing stuff out, asking people if they have questions. We're kind of doing a twofold. We're letting them know, hey, look, you don't want to lose your voice. We don't want to lose our voice. So it's kind of twofold what we're doing. We're getting signatures, but we're getting the word out too. Hey, give Warner a shot. Time for new blood.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, time for new blood. Okay, very good. We wish you the best of luck. Tony, do you have anything to wrap it up?
Yes. When people go to the website, they'll see that there's really three or four different ways they can get involved and help our effort. At a minimum level, they can at least, you know, get a hold of us or print out a petition and then get a hold of us and collect signatures from family and friends and, you know, coworkers and so forth. People, you know, it doesn't involve them going to any strangers whatsoever, and they can probably get a, you know, petition sheet just just from the people they see every day or every week. So at that very minimum level, we would hope that they'd get involved. If they want to get a little bit more involved, perhaps they can contact us if they can get us to be able to speak at a coffee hour at their church or collect signatures in the parking lot after services or at a bingo game or a Legion event, whatever, wherever there's a social gathering, we can get volunteers there to collect signatures, but we need somebody to give us entree. If they wanted walking lists to get a little bit of exercise, weeknight evenings, going door-to-door in their neighborhood, we can produce a walking list that identifies for them the registered voters in their neighborhood, their ages, their names. And then finally, best and easiest way to collect signatures en masse, you know, at a rapid rate, best bang for the buck, is this weekend. A number of opportunities that we've created Facebook events for and so forth at the Heritage Fest in O'Fallon tomorrow evening, and then the parade Friday morning, and then the festival at Hughes, I'm trying to think what it's called, right behind the ballpark there. They can collect signatures there. And then also in St. Charles, there's the Riverfest parade on Friday morning, and then at Frontier Park, collect signatures Friday afternoon and then all day Saturday. So we'll be at those locations collecting signatures these next 3 days, and especially on Friday. That's before the parade. People are just sitting there waiting for the parade to start. You can easily collect, you know, dozens of signatures in an hour. And
excellent.
We would really ask people to really, you know, remember what the founders said at the end of the Declaration of Independence, where they, you know, pledged their, you know, lives, fortune, sacred honor to create this country. Maybe, you know, hopefully, to pass on a legacy to our children that we didn't lose liberty in our lifetime. Can't people at least hopefully, you know, give 3 hours of effort after what the Patriots gave to give us the gift of liberty? So that would be my final plea, is just think of what the founders went through and you know, just 3 hours on Friday, on 4th of July, would be such a great tribute to it, to help collect.
And to add to that, Lisa, You usually never see parties work together for a common goal.
Mm-hmm.
You're seeing Democrats, Libertarians, Independents, Republicans. Everybody has put their parties aside because we know what's good for this county. You have everybody working in conjunction for this.
Right.
So it's not just
not
the Republicans or the Democrats. It's everybody.
Yeah.
85% of the people came out of the polls, realized, they thought they were helping the deputies, and after they spoke with many people, oh, my God, I didn't want to do that. I was deceived. I was misled.
Absolutely.
Right.
There's no better way to spend
cross lines.
Yeah, absolutely, folks. And there is no better way to spend the 4th of July celebrating your liberty than actually fighting for your liberty on this local level, preserving your right to be able to vote for and maintain your sheriff's department here in this county and across the country, folks, because I'm telling you, this is not happening just in St. Charles County, Missouri. This is happening all across our state and all across every county and every state of this country. This is a very important initiative. Please go to sheriffspreservation.com. Is that the correct site?
Sheriffpreservation.org.
.org. Okay, sheriffspreservation.org. And then go
and
support.
And there's no S on the end. It's sheriffpreservation.org.
Okay. Sheriffpreservation.org and then warnerforsheriff.com. Get the right people in office here, folks. We have a very entrenched, progressive, Republican control of St. Charles County. There are a lot of seats up for renewal here in the primary in August. This is a good one to start with. Thank you, gentlemen. I really appreciate you both being with me today. Please come back and keep us updated on how you're doing. Let me know if you need anything. We'll make announcements as time goes by.
All right.
Great.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us on, Lisa. Appreciate it.
Okay, we'll be right back after this break with Paul Ellison.
The affirmative task we have now is to actually create a new world order, because the global order is changing again. And the institutions and the rules that worked so well in the post-World War II era for decades, they need to be strengthened.
Hey, free market capitalist Missouri business owners, show Missouri and the rest of the country what hardworking, successful entrepreneurship looks like by advertising your business on Missouri Grassroots Radio. Get your message out to liberty-loving citizens who want to support liberty-loving capitalists. Target this unique and widespread market with your business's unique and valuable products and services. Contact us at info@missourigrassrootscoalition.org for details.
You live here?
Yes.
Well, maybe you know what a zombie is.
When a person dies and is buried, it seems a certain voodoo priest who have the power to bring him back to life.
Horrible.
It's worse than horrible, because a zombie has no will of his own. You see them sometimes, walking around blindly with dead eyes, following orders, not knowing what they do, not caring.
You mean like Democrats?
And the government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth.
We're back. This is Lisa Payne Nager listening. You're listening to Missouri Grassroots Radio, Culture Vigilante. We're here every Wednesday night at 7 p.m. We've been kind of running long. I want to make sure to get this next guest in before we play our Bill Federer interview, our Independence Day interview with Bill Federer. Paul Ellison is on it. He has been covering this issue like nobody's business. Stuff going on in Camden County, folks, is just unbelievable. And what's even more unbelievable is that it's going on everywhere. We just don't have other people in other places to cover it the way he's on top of it. Paul, thank you so much for coming back on with me tonight. What is going on down there with this poor child that evidently has passed away?
Well, first, thank you, Lisa, so much for having me on. I always enjoy the opportunity to talk to you, and unfortunately, you're right. There aren't nearly enough people paying attention to what's going on with Child Protective Services and how that's being administered throughout the state. As part of our ongoing investigation into some of these issues here in our own area, we came across a story that had to do with the Laclede County Department of Family Services. A young lady from Florida was looking for her boyfriend's or fiancé's children. They had been taken from the state of Florida and from his custody over 8 years ago. And these two children were taken by their mother. Both parents at that time were still married, so both parents had legal custody. But since, it has literally, it had turned into a game of cat and mouse as the mother and her children ran across the country in despicably deplorable conditions in some cases.
So did she take the children legally, or did she kidnap them and abduct them?
Well, she had legal custody. They were married at the time of the abduction. So there was not anything illegal as far as any of that goes. There were several attempts to try to locate her whereabouts by the Danley family. Abby and Alex were Dean's children, the oldest of five children that mother and now boyfriend Jeff Nelson have had together, I should say.
Mm-hmm.
They have three young children in addition to Abby and Alex, Gabriel being the youngest of the, or the middle of those youngest children. Gabriel came to our attention as a result of Tanya and Dean's efforts to find Alex and Abby. they were posting online in Laclede County in Lebanon, Missouri, on garage sale sites and yard sale sites, giving descriptions and pictures through Facebook of the children, and they asked that the community keep an eye out for these children because they were living in pretty substandard conditions, and their father wanted to give them a stable home. To that effect, that brought our attention to this case, and Tanya told us about her interactions with or attempts to try to find the children. Her efforts in the state of Oklahoma, where DCF for Oklahoma got involved, were fruitless. They did an investigation and went to the home where the children were. They found it to be pretty awful living conditions. But as they told the families, oh, I'm sorry, is
Paul,
that better, Lisa?
There?
Lisa, is that better? Hello? Lisa?
Paul, we're losing you.
Okay, hang on. Can you hear me?
Nope. I think we lost. We're going to wait just a second to see. Oh, hello. Oh, we lost Paul Ellison. We'll give him a second just to call back. We're running low on... Oh, are you there, Paul? Because I'm not seeing you on my board. Are you there? I think we just lost Paul Ellison. We're trying to get him back. Hopefully he'll call back real quick, and we'll try to finish this interview. Oops. There we go. Are you there, Paul?
Hi, Lisa. Yes, I am. Can you hear me now?
Hello. Paul Ellison.
Can you hear me now, Lisa?
That's better. Okay, real quick.
Okay, now you can hear me? Yes, ma'am.
We have bad reception down there at the lake where Paul is. Let's try to see if we can switch this up and get him back on the air. Okay, Paul, can
okay,
you hear me?
Okay, Lisa, how's... Yes, I can. Can you hear me?
Hello?
Wow.
Okay, some of the listeners can hear you, but I can't hear you. So we have just about, 3 minutes. Let's see if we can get you going. Oh, nope, he's dropped again. Sorry about that, folks. We're having some issues with Blog Talk Radio tonight, some reception problems. Really wanted to get this story in. If we don't get it in this week, we will absolutely get it in next week. I know there are a lot of callers on the line trying to hear this. There's a lot of craziness going on down in that part of the state. There we go. Let's try it again.
All right,
Paul?
Lisa, can you hear me now?
You're good.
All right. I'm so sorry. I've been having some issues with my own reception today, so I'm sure it's on my end. I apologize for that.
No problem. Okay, so
as
real
I was
quick.
Saying, sure, go ahead.
Yeah, we're going to run out of time here real quick. Can you give us the
you
condensed
bet. To make a very long story short, Danleys were looking for their own two children. The other three children were, of course, the mother's responsibility with the boyfriend. DCF investigated this over the course of the winter, remembering how brutally cold it was when the family was living in a storage shed after having bounced from motel to motel and having destroyed and done damage to several local hotel rooms. The DCF still did not seek to intervene on the children's behalf, even though the conditions they were living in obviously were not exactly up to snuff. They actually told the Danleys, did the Department of Family Services in Laclede County, that if they continued to try to look for Abby and Alex, that they would be charged with cyberstalking or harassment. The mother and her boyfriend. No kidding. And this is an agent that has been involved as well with the Lagares case, and Ms. Nikki Watson. And so it's not an isolated incident. What essentially happened was that the Danleys managed to, and it's quite a story, I know we don't have time for, but they managed to actually regain custody of both Alex and Abby about 2 months ago or so. But they did not and have any claim to the other three children in the household. Those children were given back to the mother and the boyfriend. They were living in a motel room in Springfield, which was the pattern. And according to the accounts that were given by the boyfriend, relayed to Alex and Abby in Florida on the telephone, and things that came out with the obituary, Gabriel passed away on the 19th of June as a result of a seizure. The boy had the flu, apparently, at that time, and the mother was gone to get medicine for that. And when she returned, the story changed a couple of different times as to whether or not Gabriel was still alive when she returned with Tylenol from the store or whether he was not. And certainly I'm not going to try to say that the seizure is directly related to neglect, although there was certainly quite a history in talking to Abby and Alex of medical neglect taking place regularly, as the family simply didn't have the money to take care of basic needs in that way. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I guess really what this story crystallizes for us here is that instead of an agency that is doing its job or function, protecting these children that are living in storage units in sub-zero weather, that are making sure these children are clean, fed, and taken care of, they're becoming targeted and punitive, and they decide how and when
punitive.
They want to apply those, you know, apply their office.
Oh, you know, I mean, there's so many issues that I want to get into with this situation, and I want to get an update on the Lagares family as well, and we don't have time for tonight, but it is important for folks to become aware of the things that are going on that never get reported on in the mainstream media. You don't ever hear about it unless, you know, maybe you're personally tied to the situation. You don't know what's going on behind the scenes in the court systems and how these things are kind of, air quotes, slipping through the cracks. You know, a young child lost their life because of bad decisions made. You know, I mean, one only needs to follow the case of Justina Pelletier, and it is not an isolated case. This kind of thing is going on across the country on various levels for various reasons. You have done a great job, Paul, of finding these cases and reporting on them. Folks can go to American Spring 2011 to maintain, you know, if you want to maintain a day-to-day update on these issues. Paul, can you come back next week, Paul, and talk about this a little bit more?
I would love to. It'd be my pleasure. I apologize for kind of cutting into our time tonight with
no
my
problem.
Reception issues, but I always
Actually,
look
I'd
forward
like to
it.
I would like to – I'm going to cut you a segment where we have a lot more time to get into these things in detail, because people really need to know what is going on. You know, these are not isolated cases. It's bad news, and people need to be, even those of us who are engaged in the movement just do not understand it. So, Paul, thank you so much for coming on tonight, and we're gonna have Paul back on next week. We're gonna put him on first part of the hour to talk about these cases and get an update on the Lagares family. I'm sure there's a lot going on.
There definitely is, Lisa. Just quickly, I know you have to go, folks. Persistence pays off in these cases. It appears that Anonymous, the internet group that has been involved in cases like the one in Maryville, have taken an interest in what's going on at the Lake of the Ozarks. We just found that out today, and you can check out the video that they have put out. We posted it just right before we went on the air on the Facebook page, Guerrilla Radio with American Spring. So thanks again, Lisa, so much for having me on.
And we'll talk to you next week, Paul. Thank you so much.
All right. Have a great night.
Thank you. Happy 4th of July. Okay, folks, we're going to start this Bill Federer interview. It runs kind of long, so it's going to run all the way to the end. I think we're going to get the last minute of it in. Happy 4th of July. If I don't speak to you at the end of the show, do what you can to celebrate your Independence Day and enjoy this Bill Federer interview.
This is Lisa Payne Nager, and you're listening to Culture Vigilante on Missouri Grassroots Radio. And for our Independence Day broadcast, I thought it would be a great idea to have Bill Federer drop in and give us Another great history lesson. Nobody knows more about American history than Bill Federer, and he's got a great book outlining the Independence Day history and all of the things that led up to that, and we're just going to touch base with him and let him fill us in on the details. Thanks for being with us today, Bill.
Well, thank you, Lisa. It's great to be with you.
And we really appreciate you dropping in. I thought it would be a great idea to have you on for our Independence Day broadcast, since I know no other historian more knowledgeable about American history. So what have you got for us today?
Well, the most common form of government in all of world history is dictators. And from the very beginning of recorded human history, around 3 or 4,000 B.C., there were pharaohs and Caesars and Kaisers, Sultans, Tsars, Maharajas, Genghis Khan, Julius Caesar. And no matter where you went in the world in these 60 centuries, power inevitably gravitates into the hands of one person. That's the norm. I believe it goes back to the fall in the garden and sin coming into the human DNA and Cain killing Abel and one king taking a kingdom from another king. And so you put some babies in a crib, one of them will take the rattle from the others. And you put some kids on a playground, one of them winds up taking the being the bully hogging the ball, and you put some people in the woods, one of them's the Indian chief, and put them in an inner city, one of them's the gang leader. So this is the norm, and if you're friends with the king, you're more equal. If you're not friends with the king, you're less equal, and if you're an enemy of the king, you're dead. It's called treason. So that's the norm. What's rare in history is people getting an opportunity to experiment with doing something different, like ruling themselves without a king. And the first nation that we have a record of that was ruled without a king was Israel. When they come out of Egypt, where the Pharaoh controlled everything, and they come into the promised land, and for 200 years they don't have a king. Anyway, after 200 years, they end up getting so out of control that everyone did what was right in their own eyes, and they ended up getting a King Saul. Athens, from around 600 to 300 BC, they had an experiment they called democracy, until Alexander the Great had conquered them. Rome, from about 509 B.C. to 27 B.C., had a republic with 600 senators, until one of the senators named Julius Caesar made himself dictator for life, and then they became the Roman Empire, where it's all owned by the emperor, so it was no longer a republic. And but you go throughout history, and you had some Italian city-states until Napoleon conquered them. You had a commonwealth in Iceland from 900 to 1200 until the king of Denmark conquered them. There was a republic in North Russia called Novgorod on the North Sea, and they would gather in the town square and shout for their leader, and whoever got the loudest shout was elected until Ivan the Terrible of Moscow conquered them and killed 60,000 of them and incorporated Novgorod into Russia. And then you have the Dutch Republic, Seven United Netherlands, and until Napoleon conquered what was left of them. And then finally you come to the British Empire. And they had a short republic for about 15 years when the Puritans took over. But they came back with Charles II and finally worked their way up to King George III. And the King of England was the most powerful monarch in world history. The British Empire eventually had 13 million square miles and a half a billion people. All of India, which is a quarter of the world's population right there, they had Hong Kong and New Zealand and Australia and British Guyana and, of course, Canada and then the Americas, and then they had, you know, parts of Africa. And the sun never set on the British Empire, and here comes along America, and we decide we're going to break away. Well, a little background is there were challenging empires. There was the Dutch for a while until they were... the Dutch and the English teamed up against Spain. Once they were successful in, you know, breaking that monopoly, the British decided to go after the Dutch. And so it sort of became a real tug of war between the French and the English. And so they both had global empires. The French had areas of Africa, and they had the French Indonesia and, you know, Vietnam, Cambodia area. They had... French Guyana, and so these were two global empires, plus they had originally all of Canada, and then all of the Louisiana Territory, everything west of the Appalachians and east of the Rockies. And so we had the French and the English start the first global war, and it's called the French and Indian War in America, and then in Europe it's called the Seven Years' War. Anyway, the British win, and they end up wanting to leave troops on American soil to prevent there from being any more problems. But they didn't have any barracks to leave these troops in, and so they get the wild idea that they're going to put the troops in your house. And so these troops would just go up to people's houses and quarter in the house. They would come in and live in your house, eat your food, and sleep in your bed, and you would have to sleep in the attic or the basement or the barn. And it's called quartering. And the Americans in Boston gathered in 1770, and there was a mob protesting, and the British fired into the mob and killed a bunch of them. They killed Crispus Attucks, who was an African-American who was one of the first to die in the Revolutionary conflict. Then the King of England decided he was going to tax the colonies to pay for the troops. So not only do you have the policemen, you know, living in your home, you've got to pay extra taxes to the government to pay for these guys. And so they passed the tea tax and the sugar tax and the stamp tax, all these taxes. And finally, in 1773, the colonists decided they've had enough of this, and they go down to protest the taxes by throwing 342 chests of British East India tea into the harbor, and this is known as the Boston Tea Party. Well, the King of England doesn't like the Tea Party movement, and he decides to punish those that participated in the Tea Party movement, like targeting them. he decides to blockade Boston's harbor on June 1st, 1774, to starve them into submission. Sort of like using the power of the government to go after these Tea Party groups. In the neighboring state colony of Virginia, there is Thomas Jefferson, and he decides to propose a day of fasting, and he writes this, and it is introduced into the Virginia legislature by Robert Carter Nicholas. It passes unanimously with the support of Patrick Henry, Richard Henry Lee, George Mason, and it says, "This House, being deeply impressed with the apprehension of the great dangers to be derived to British America from the hostile invasion of the city of Boston in our sister colony of Massachusetts, deem it highly necessary that the said first day of June be set apart by the members of this House as a day of fasting, humiliation, and prayer." Well, they gather that day, and they march down the street to the Bruton Parish Church, and they fast all day. George Washington writes in his diary, June 1st, 1774, went to church, fasted all day. Well, the Virginia governor is Lord Dunmore. He is a royal governor, meaning appointed by the king. And he views this day of fasting as some kind of veiled protest against the king, because it's the king's policies that is blockading Boston's harbor. And so this Lord Dunmore decides to disband the Virginia legislature, the House of Burgesses. He fires them, tells them to go home. Well, they don't go home. They go down the street to Raleigh Tavern. And in the back room, they plot to have a Continental Congress to meet in Philadelphia 3 months later. And sure enough, they meet, and then 2 years after that, the Continental Congress votes for independence. So we may not have had a vote for independence, and we may not have had a Continental Congress if it had not been for Thomas Jefferson proposing a day of fasting and prayer, June 1st, 1774. Well, they do meet in September of 1774 in Philadelphia, Carpenter's Hall, and there's a motion to open with prayer. And some of the Presbyterians don't want to hear a prayer from an Episcopalian, who doesn't want to hear a prayer from a Quaker or an Anabaptist or a Congregationalist. And it begins to get so divided before they get started that Sam Adams stands up. And he says, "I'm no bigot. I can hear a prayer of any man of piety who at the same time is a friend of his country." And so they get the Anglican minister of the biggest church in Philadelphia. It's Reverend Mr. Jacob Duché. And he opens with prayer. And they read from the 35th Psalm, and then he breaks out into an extemporaneous prayer, which John Adams said, "filled the bosom of every person present. I must confess I never heard a better prayer." After that is when, later in Philadelphia, when when they have the Declaration of Independence, that same Jacob Boucher goes back across the church, opens up his English Common Prayer book, and he takes a pen and he scratches out every place where it says to pray for the king, and he puts in pray for the United States of America. And so this sets a ripple effect that the church was taking a stand against this concentrated power of this monarch. Anyway, so that was September of 1774. In the beginning of 1775, the governor of Massachusetts, the provincial governor, in other words, the royal governor is there by the king, and the provincial one is the ones that the people of the colonies vote in. And so they have a Massachusetts Provincial Congress led by John Hancock, the richest man in Boston, and he signs off on a proclamation of prayer. And he says, in circumstances dark as these, it becomes us as men and Christians to reflect that whilst every prudent measure should be taken to ward off impending judgments, the 11th of May should be set apart as a day of public fasting, prayer, and humiliation to confess our sins. Well, that was April 15th of 1775. April 19th of 1775, in Massachusetts, the British decide they're going to arrest John Hancock and Sam Adams, and they send troops to Concord and Lexington to get them. And so there was an arrangement to warn them ahead of time, and somebody was going to stand in the belfry of a church and hang a lantern. One, if the British were going to be coming toward Lexington and Concord by land, and two, if by sea. And so they put the lanterns up there, and they let them know, and so the guys, Paul Revere and a couple others, get on horses and take off running. They see the lanterns, they take off riding as fast as they can to warn the British are coming to get John Hancock and Sam Adams and all their guns. And so they ride over to Lexington and Concord, and that is where the shot is heard round the world. That was the poem that Ralph Waldo Emerson wrote. He says, by this rude bridge that arched the flood, the flag of April's breeze unfurled. Here once the embattled farmers stood and fired the shot heard round the world. And so they were standing up to the most powerful empire in the world, the British Empire, these ragtag guys. The same day, April 19th, 1775, the Connecticut governor is John Trumbull. He declares a day of fasting. God would graciously pour out his Holy Spirit upon us to the thorough repentance and effectual reformation of our iniquities, that they may not be our ruin, and so on and so forth. So New England sets apart April 19th as Patriots Day. And so then June, 2 months after the Battle of Lexington and Concord, now John Hancock, who avoided getting arrested, he's now the president of the Continental Congress. And John Hancock does what on June 12th? Declare a day of fasting and prayer. Congress, considering the great present critical and alarming calamitous state, do earnestly recommend Thursday, the 12th of July, 1775, be observed by the inhabitants of the English colonies as a day of public humiliation, fasting, and prayer, that we may with united hearts and voices unfeignedly confess and deplore our sins. It is recommended to Christians of all denominations to assemble for public worship and abstain from servile labor on said day. Well, what happens next? Well, that was June of 1775, the beginning of it, June 12th. Well, what happens on June 17th, just a few days later? The British decide not only are they going to blockade Boston's harbor, they are going to inhabit Boston. And so is the Battle of Bunker Hill. Is this following a timeline that's understandable?
You're doing great. This is an amazing recounting of history. And what strikes me is the more things change, the more things stay the same.
Yeah, they really do. It's interesting how human nature repeats itself. So don't shoot till you see the whites of their eyes. That was the order given June 17, 1775 by Colonel William Prescott. He was commanding the troops at Breed's Hill, across from Bunker Hill, which was guarding the north entrance to Boston's harbor. Now, providentially, this being the first use of British naval ships during the war, the British inadvertently brought the wrong size cannonballs. So normally they would have had their ships there and pounded away at American entrenchments with cannonballs and then unload their troops and march up and do a little mop-up, you know, of who's still alive. Well, since they brought the wrong size cannonballs, the British General Howe had to disembark 2,300 British soldiers and send them up the hill with bayonets fixed. Twice the Americans repelled them, and had they not split their gunpowder, because the guy, you know, somebody that wanted to have half the gunpowder in Cambridge, but if they would have had all the gunpowder there, they could have killed them all. But nevertheless, the Americans ran out of gunpowder, and the British were able to take the hill. But nevertheless, 1,000 British were killed and 500 Americans. And this let the Americans know that they could feel their own against the finest military in the world. The same day, 300 miles away, the Continental Congress decides to draft George Washington as the commander-in-chief. And he refuses to take a salary. And he writes a will for his wife, and he takes off, and he writes to her, I therefore confidently rely on that providence which is heretofore preserved and been bountiful to me. So July of 1775, there's John Adams, and he writes to his wife on July 12th. He said, we have appointed a continental fast. Millions will be upon their knees at once before the great Creator, imploring his forgiveness and blessing and smiles on American counsel and arms. And so July 19th, 1775, the journals of the Continental Congress record agreed. The Continental Congress, the Congress, meet here tomorrow morning, half after 9, in order to attend divine service at Mr. Jacob Duché's church. We remember him. And in the afternoon, they will go to attend divine service at Dr. Allison's church. So they were doing their fasting and praying. And on time, the governor of Connecticut, John Trumbull, writes to George Washington. He says, may the God of the armies of Israel shower down the blessings of his divine providence in the day of battle and danger. So the British now have occupied Boston. They burn Cambridge. And there's a 25-year-old bookseller in Boston who had his bookshop trashed by the British, and his name is Henry Knox. So he and his wife Lucy flee, and he joins George Washington, who's 43 years old. And this 25-year-old Henry Knox has this idea of going to Fort Ticonderoga, 300 miles away, and dragging down 57 huge cannons in the middle of winter, in the freezing snow, and it takes him 3 months. And he builds these big sleds, and as they're going across a frozen lake, the ice wasn't thick enough, and one of them falls through, and the men of Albany, New York, help him fish out the cannon, and he finally drags these, he's 25 years old, he finally drags these things to Boston. And on March 4th at nighttime of 1776, we have Henry Knox and George Washington. They put straw on the wagon wheels to muffle the sound, and they wheel these cannons to the top of Dorchester Heights, which was the highest hill overlooking Boston's harbor. There wasn't anything there, and the British had inadvertently failed to take that position, and now they wake up on March 5th, 1776, and the British General Howe looks up and remarks, the rebels did more in one night than my whole army could do in 1 month. And Washington had even taken a bunch of logs and painted them black and stuck those up there, too, to make it look like even more cannons on the hill. So the next day, March 6th, 1776, George Washington gives the order. He says, Thursday the 7th, being set apart by this province of Massachusetts as a day of fasting, prayer, and humiliation to implore the Lord and Giver of victory to pardon our manifold sins and transgressions. And all officers and soldiers are strictly enjoined to pay due reverence on that day to the sacred duty of the Lord of hosts. And for those blessings which our holiness and uprightness of life can alone encourage us to receive. So that was March 6th. March 7th, General Howe had planned to attack the Dorchester Heights cannons, and he had 3,000 troops that he was loading onto ships, and all of a sudden it gets so stormy that he has to call it off. And Washington writes to his brother Upon their discovery of the works the next day, great preparation was made for attacking them, but not being ready before afternoon and the weather getting very tempestuous, much blood was saved and a very important blow prevented. That this most remarkable interposition of Providence is for some wise purpose, I have not a doubt. And so the next day, March 8, 1776, General Howe sends the word to Washington that if Washington won't shoot them with cannons while they're pulling out of the harbor, he won't torch the city on his way out. And so this is the first real victory of the war where here we are, this ragtag Americans, and we're forcing the most powerful Navy and military force in the world to leave Boston. Amazing. And so eight days pass, and the Continental Congress has another day of fasting and prayer, and this is written on March 16th, introduced by the General William Livingston. And so the British pull out. Now what happens next? The British go to New York. And so George Washington goes to New York. And everybody thought, that was really easy, Boston. We can do this. We can win this war quick. And so 20,000 guys volunteer for 6 months to join Washington's ranks. And here he is digging in New York on Brooklyn Heights, whereas before they were on, you know, the Bunker Hill and Breed's Hill. Now they're on this Brooklyn Heights. And so they're facing the sea. Well, while they're waiting, somebody rushes out to Washington a copy of the Declaration of Independence, which mentions God four times, laws of nature and of nature's God, and endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights, appealing to the supreme judge of the world and with a firm reliance on the protection of divine providence. And so Washington's facing the water, and lo and behold, there's a loyalist. Now, what's a loyalist? That's somebody who's loyal to the King of England and not to America. So it's a traitor, basically, to America. And so we have enemies, foreign and domestic. Here is somebody that's in America, but they're not loyal to America. They're loyal to our enemies. And so what does this loyalist do? He shows the British to land up the coast a little ways and shows them a way to get through Jamaica Pass in the pitch black at nighttime. And on the morning of August 27th, 1776, they attack, and an estimated 3,000 Americans are killed or wounded, and only 392 British. But these 10,000 British troops are just storming at Washington, and he's got all of his cannons facing the water. And so there's the brave Maryland Regiment. These guys charge six times directly into the British lines, and just about all of them get killed. And Washington said, good God, what brave fellows I've lost this day. But they buy him time, so Washington is able to turn around and now face the British, and then the sun goes down. And Washington's pinned up against the water with the most powerful invasion force on the water, and then these 10,000 troops facing him from the other direction. And the next day, the war is over. And we're just going to be another British colony like Kenya or India. But Washington gets this idea of getting every boat he can find and ferrying his troops all night long across the East River to Manhattan Island. And it's unseasonably boisterous water where the British ships are, but it's calm where the East River was. And so Washington's having them going back and forth, having horses and troops and cannons, and then the sun begins to come up, and half of his men are still on duty waiting in line to get on boats, and now there's not enough army there left to fight any battles, and what escaped is not enough to fight any battles, and so the war still would have been over, but Washington's chief of intelligence, Major Ben Talmadge, writes this: as the dawn of the next day approached, those of us who remained in the trenches became very anxious for our own safety. And when the dawn appeared, there were several regiments still on duty. At this time, a very dense fog began to rise off the river, and it seemed to settle in a peculiar manner over both encampments. I recollect this peculiar providential occurrence perfectly well, and so very dense was the atmosphere that I could scarcely discern a man at 6 yards distance. We tarried until the sun had risen, but the fog remained as dense as ever. Well, Washington was on the last boat that left Brooklyn Heights. The fog lifts, the British charge, and no one's there. This was the last chance the British had to capture the entire American army in one fell swoop. Washington said later, the hand of Providence has been so conspicuous in the course of the war that he must be worse than an infidel that lacks faith. Well, what happens next? Washington is on Manhattan Island, and he's chased off. He's chased all the way across New York, all the way across New Jersey, and then forced to cross the Delaware River into Pennsylvania. 6 months has gone by. He's lost every battle. His troops dwindle from 20,000 down to 2,000. And these guys are ragtag. They're tired. They're worn out. It's freezing cold. And they only agree to enlist for 6 months. And so July to December, Washington has like a week left before his army is gone. And the war is going to be over because there's no army to fight. And Washington then gets a note from Continental Congress saying, we're evacuating Philadelphia because we sort of figure the British are going to cross the Delaware River and take Philadelphia. And so until further notice, you're in charge of America. So here's Washington, and he has a speech to his troops begging them for one more battle. And he has a mission, and he uses the code word victory or death. And so he breaks his men into three groups, and on Christmas Day evening, 1776, he has his men cross the Delaware River back into New Jersey. Well, the ice is so thick, two of his groups don't make it across. Only one makes it across at Meconkie Ferry. There's a blizzard that night. One of his men freezes to death on the march. They're in pitch-black silence marching. Someone rushes in to the dinner of John Rolfe, who is the Hessian commander at Trenton. You say, who are the Hessians? The Hessians were a killing machine. I mean, in Europe, they would have, kingdoms with kings, and they would fight battles. But as the centuries went on, the countries, these little kingdoms pretty well had their boundaries set. And they would have their armies, and they would sort of loan them out. And so the King of England used gold to buy mercenary troops from this German area of Hessia. And so these guys came across, and they were paid killers. And they were organized, and they were very disciplined and feared. And so here's Washington marching up, and around 4 o'clock in the morning, they get to Trenton. And his men can't hold back anymore. They just storm into Trenton, and they are shooting at these Hessian troops from behind trees and bushes and street posts. And the Hessians are taught to fight in an open field, with one line of them shooting and another line reloading and another line aiming. So it's this volley, and they weren't used to doing this guerrilla warfare. And then Alexander Hamilton wheels a cannon down the street and fills it full of grape shot, shoots it down the street, and mows down a bunch of them. And finally, John Rolfe, the Hessian commander, gets a group of them together. They're in a field, and they're lining up to get ready to do their killing machine when he gets shot, and he slumps off his horse, and the Hessians surrender. And they bring him up to the, one of the upstairs rooms in a building, and he's dying, and he's, sending a message to Washington to come up so that he can surrender and hand him his sword, which is the valiant way of doing things. And Washington refuses. He says, I have no respect for mercenaries, people that are killing for money. He says, And anyway, the Americans capture 1,000 of these German Hessian feared troops. What does Washington do? Well, he takes them across the Delaware River into Pennsylvania, makes them promise not to fight Americans again, and he lets them go. Now, you contrast that to the British. When they would capture the Americans, they would stick them in prisons. When the prisons filled up, they turned churches and schools into prisons. When they filled up, they turned boats into prisons. And so they had the Jersey and these different ships in the New York Harbor, and they would put the captured Americans on there, and they would starve to death. More Americans died on British starving ships than died in battle. Thousands died. Anyway, so Washington, now, the word gets to Cornwallis, the British commander, that the Americans captured Trenton. And so Cornwallis sends another huge army down there. So it's 10 days later, and it's January of 1775, and it's at Princeton. And the two armies are facing each other. The next day is the battle, and Washington leaves his troops, or his campfire's burning. And he leaves a couple guys in the camp to bang pots and pans, And he takes the rest of the army out the back of the camp quietly, and he marches them quietly all night long to the other side of Princeton. The dawn comes up, the British charge into an empty camp, Washington charges them from behind. And before he can capture them, the British turn, and they're going to fight back. And so some of the Americans get scared, and they're retreating, and it's all turning into this mad rush retreat, and Washington sees his men are going to get routed. So what does Washington do? He rides up to where his men are running, and he yells at them to follow him. And then he, on his horse, he's riding right toward the British who are charging him. He gets within 30 yards of the British. Washington turns, faces his men, and yells, "Fire." Well, they fire past Washington at the British. The British return the fire, and Washington's in the middle of the field. Everybody is convinced he's dead, but when the smoke clears, because those old, you know, guns would have a lot of smoke, when the smoke cleared, there's Washington waving his hat saying, "Charge." And so the Americans charge and capture 800 more of the British, and this is the battles of Trenton and Princeton. And all of a sudden, it gives the American cause a shot in the arm. This is enthusiasm sweeping the country. And the president of Yale is Ezra Stiles. And he writes this. He said, "In our lowest, most dangerous state, we sustained ourselves against the British army of 60,000 troops, commanded by the ablest generals Britain could procure throughout Europe, with a naval force of 22,000 seamen and above 80 men of war. Independence was sealed and confirmed by God Almighty in the victory of General Washington at Trenton and in the surprising movement and the Battle of Princeton. Who but a Washington inspired by heaven could have struck out the great movement and maneuver at Princeton? The United States are under peculiar obligations to become a holy people unto the Lord our God." Now, there's the Battle of Saratoga. And so we're talking June of 1777. There is a British general, Johnny Burgoyne, and he lands in Canada, and he's coming down, and he makes a treaty with the Mohawk Indians to commit terrorist attacks. So here's a sort of like a Fast and Furious, you know, where the government supplies arms to the drug gangs. So to do the, here was General Johnny Burgoyne, a British general, having these Indians do terrorist attacks against the Americans. And they're, you know, killing and butchering, and the Americans are just befuddled. We don't know what to do. But then, as they get close to some of the encampments, settlements, there's loyalists, but the Indians cannot tell the difference between a white loyalist to Britain and a white patriot in America. And they go to the one little settlement, and there is a sweet girl named Jane McCrae, who had long, beautiful hair, and she was engaged to a British-American loyalist named David Jones, and he kisses her goodbye and goes off and joins General Johnny Burgoyne, and, you know, I'm sure he told her, "I'll be back, we'll get rid of these rebels," you know. Well, as they're getting close, and I guess he's probably getting excited, he's going to see his fiancée again, as they're getting close, one night the Indians come into the camp with the scalps that they got from their outings the night before, and he sees this one scalp that's really long, pretty, beautiful hair that he recognizes as his fiance. Sure enough, they shot Jane McCrae and scalped her. That was his fiance. And so this causes an uproar in the British camp that these, you know, terrorists are terrorizing the wrong groups. And so Burgoyne calls a meeting with the Mohawk Indians and tells them to tone it down. Well, the Indians only know on and off. They're either at war or they're at peace. They don't know any limited warfare where you fight with your hand behind your back type of thing, you know. And so they get offended and leave. And they leave Burgoyne in the middle of the New York forest, and all of a sudden he's blind. He doesn't know where he's at. He doesn't know where the Americans are at. He doesn't know any reconnaissance. He doesn't know where the water is. He doesn't know anything. He's just stuck there. And so this gives suddenly the Americans the advantage. And we capture the Battle of Saratoga, 6,000 British troops. And this is considered a major turning point in the war. And this convinces King Louis XVI of France that maybe the Americans can win this thing, and that eventually causes him to send his navy over to help us. And when word comes of the victory, Washington writes to his brother, I most devoutly congratulate my country and every well-wisher to the cause on this signal stroke of providence. And the Continental Congress declares the first National Day of Thanksgiving, November 1st, 1777, that with one heart and one voice, the good people may express the grateful feelings of their hearts, join in penitent confession of their manifold sins, that it may please God through the merits of Jesus Christ mercifully to forgive and blot out their sins, and under the providence of Almighty God secure the victory, so forth. Roger Sherman, who was a signer of the Declaration, said, "This is the Lord's doing, and it is marvelous in our eyes." Anyway, so that was the October of 1777. So we've gone from the Boston Massacre to the Boston Tea Party to blockading the Boston's harbor to the cannons on Dorchester Heights to the New York, and then Washington 6 months losing, and then they winning the Battle of Trenton and Princeton. Then we win the Battle of Saratoga, and then we come up to Valley Forge. And so this is the end of 1777, beginning of 1778. 2,500 Americans died, froze to death of exposure, hunger, and disease, while the British are living in comfort in Philadelphia. And anyway, don't have time to tell all the stories.
Yeah.
But,
go right ahead.
Go ahead.
Yes, go right ahead. I'm enjoying this immensely. Go ahead.
Okay, well, the British are in Philadelphia, and Washington is there in Valley Forge. A Prussian officer, somebody from, you know, the killing machines over there in Prussian Germany, a Prussian officer shows up offering his services to Washington. His name is Baron von Steuben, and he can speak, you know, German and French, but there's somebody in America that can speak French and English, and so he gives his orders in French, and then it's translated from French to English, and he trains and drills the Americans on how to fight like a real army, and not just, you know, this ragtag militia type of thing. And anyway, I could go on and on, but they, you know, have another day of prayer and fasting, April 12th of 1778. The Honorable Congress, having thought proper to recommend the United States to observe a day of fasting, humiliation, prayer, one time with one voice, that the righteous dispensation to providence may be acknowledged, and the general directs that that day should be most religiously observed by the Army. And Washington says, to the distinguished character of patriot, it should be our highest glory to laud the more distinguished character of Christian. And so now we're coming up on 1779, and the Continental Congress asks the states to declare a day of prayer. And so who is the governor of Virginia in 1779 but Thomas Jefferson? And so Thomas Jefferson gives this proclamation. He said, "Congress hath thought proper to recommend to the several states a day of public and solemn thanksgiving to Almighty God for his mercies, and of prayer for the continuance of his favor, that he would go forth with our hosts and crown our army with victory, that he would grant his church the plentiful effusions of his divine grace and pour out his Holy Spirit on all ministers of the gospel, that he would bless and prosper the means of education and spread the light of Christian knowledge through the remotest corners of the earth. I do therefore issue this proclamation appointing a day of public and solemn thanksgiving and prayer to Almighty God, signed Thomas Jefferson, November 11th, 1779. Anyway, Washington, then we're into the spring of 1780, and he gives another order to his troops. Congress, having been pleased by their proclamation to declare another day of fasting, humiliation, and prayer, he says there should be no labor or recreation on that day. So now we're into August of 1780, and Benedict Arnold, he is the hero of the Battle of Saratoga, because he led a charge, you know, along the flank, but he sort of disobeyed an order to do that. Everybody, you know, knew that he was vindicated because we won the war, but he had to go through the court-martial procedure. They found him innocent, but it was sort of an annoyance for him, and his wife felt like these Americans really didn't appreciate her husband, and so she begins to meet with a British spy named John Andre, and she finally convinces her husband, Benedict Arnold, to meet the British. British spy John Andre, and Benedict Arnold gives in and agrees to betray West Point for $20,000, 20,000 pounds, which is equivalent to about $1 million. So West Point is on the Hudson River. The Hudson River goes north and south, cutting New York in half and cutting America in half. You have New England on one side and the middle southern colonies on the other. So if you can control the Hudson River and if you can control West Point, you can control America. And just so happens, Washington was planning on visiting West Point the next day. So Benedict Arnold meets with the spy, John Andre, gives him a map of West Point. He's sneaking back dressed as a civilian to the British lines. And then the sun comes up and here's Benedict Arnold. He's waiting to have breakfast with Washington, who is inspecting the troops. Washington's running late because he's inspecting the troops. And meanwhile, somebody tells Benedict Arnold that his spy got captured. Sure enough, some Americans saw this guy sneaking through the woods dressed as a civilian, and they say, "Stop. Who are you? What are you doing?" And his answers didn't convince him. They searched him once, twice. And the third time, they made him take off his boots, and they found in the heel of his boot, folded up, a map of West Point. And so what do? They arrest him, and they're going to march him back into Benedict Arnold's office. And so when word comes to Benedict Arnold, here he is about to meet with Washington, and he takes off, and he flees, and he gets on a ship called the Vulture, and he joins the British Army. And sure enough, later he actually fights the Americans and kills Americans. And, you know, Marquis de Lafayette, the French guy, is fighting Benedict Arnold and on our soil. And so anyway, Washington is shocked, and he gives this proclamation, this order, 1780, September 26th, treason. Of the blackest dye was yesterday discovered. General Arnold, who commanded at West Point, lost every sentiment of honor in public and private obligation, was about to deliver up that important post to our enemy. Such an event must have given the American cause a deadly wound, if not fatal stab. Happily, the treason had been timely discovered to prevent the fatal misfortune. The providential train of circumstances which led to its discovery affords the most convincing proof that the liberties of America are the object of divine protection. The president of Yale, Ezra Stiles, writes, "But a providential miracle detected the conspiracy of Arnold even in the critical moment of the execution of that infernal plot, in which the body of the American army then at West Point and His Excellency George Washington himself were to have been rendered into the hands of the enemy. So the Continental Congress decides they're going to declare a day of Thanksgiving." And they write this, and this is October 18th of 1780, so this is like just 2 or 3 weeks after the attempt to betray West Point. So the Continental Congress says, "In the late remarkable interposition of his watchful providence in the rescuing of the person of our commander-in-chief and the army from imminent dangers at the moment when treason was ripened for execution, it is therefore recommended a day of public thanksgiving and prayer to confess our unworthiness and to offer fervent supplications to God of all grace to cause the knowledge of Christianity to spread over all the earth." That was the Continental Congress, October 18, 1780. So what happens next, 1781? It's the Battle of Cowpens, and this was considered the strategic turning point of the war. Cowpens is where you got cows and pens, right? So it's Cowpens. And if you've seen the movie The Patriot with Mel Gibson, there is that last big battle scene with a bunch of ragtag militia standing in a field, and the American General Daniel Morgan talks to these guys and says, "Look, just give me 2 shots at the British, and then you can get scared and run away over the hill." Over the hill is, you know, some trees, and then behind the trees is the river. Now, in battle strategy, you never fight a battle without leaving yourself a way of retreat. And so you don't want to have a river behind you when you're fighting a battle, because if you're losing, there's nowhere to run away to. And so the British have their Colonel Tarleton. He's known as the Butcher because he would kill innocent people and noncombatants and women and children. And so he is riding along with his dragoons, these horses with their, you know, big tall black hats and their sabers. They're like razor blade swords. And he sees the American militia standing there backed up to the river. behind them, but he sees them and he goes, "You fools! First of all, we're the toughest troops the British have, the Dragoons. It was like the F-16. I mean, these guys could ride in, you know, galloping on the horses, and these other guys are on foot. I mean, they got these saber swords. I mean, and so Tarleton's like, "You fools, what are you doing?" So he takes the bait, and he charges. And the Americans fire one, and then they hurry up and reload. And then they fire a second time, and then they run over the hill. And Tarleton and his men follow them over the hill, only to be met at point-blank range by 400 battle-hardened crack American Continental soldiers. And they fire away, and they kill in an instant over 100 of these British soldiers, these Dragoons, and the rest of them just throw up their arms and surrender. And so Daniel Morgan captures over 800 of them. And then he hightails it out of there. And he wants to get back to Virginia, because this is in North Carolina. And he's riding, he's making his men go as fast as they can, and they cross the Catawba River. And 2 hours later, the British come up to the river. And before they can start crossing, there's a flash flood, and the river rises, and it delays the British for a half a day. And then the Americans are racing as fast as they can. They get to the Yadkin River. And so Cornwallis, the British commander, he is trashing his supply wagons, his cannons, his, you know, anything that's not necessary. He's just trashing it along the way. And he is rushing, and he gets to the Dan River and watches the Americans get out the other side. But before he can start crossing, there's another flash flood, and the river suddenly rises, and he's got to put it off. And then they chase him again, and he's trashed more of his supplies, and he finally at midnight gets to the Dan River watching the Americans get out the other side, and another flash flood. And the British commander, Henry Clinton, writes, "Here the Royal Army was again stopped by a sudden rise of the waters, which had only just fallen almost miraculously to let the enemy over." Washington wrote later, "We have abundant reasons to thank Providence for its many favorable interpositions in our behalf. It has at times been my only dependence, for all of the resources seem to have failed us." Well, Cornwallis, he has done what? He's trashed all his supplies, but he's got a whole army, and so he's ordered to wait at Yorktown by the York River, near Chesapeake Bay, for British ships to bring him some more supplies. But finally the French send their navy, King Louis XVI. The navy has one of the largest naval battles called the Battle of the Capes, and they are able to keep the British supply ships from coming to Cornwallis's rescue. And so George Washington, with 3,000 French troops from de Grasse, 6,000 French troops from General Rochambeau, he has Generals Benjamin Lincoln, Baron von Steuben, Mordecai Gist, Henry Knox, John Peter Muhlenberg, Marquis de Lafayette, 17,000 American and British troops, and they surround Cornwallis, who surrenders on October 19, 1781. And Ezra Stiles, the president of Yale, writes, "Who but God could have ordained the critical arrival of the Gallic fleet?" And Gaelic is an old word for French. And so who could have ordained the critical arrival of the French fleet so as to assist in the siege of Yorktown? I mean, the timing of it was just perfect. "Should we not ascribe to a supreme energy the wise generalship displayed by General Greene, who was with Daniel Morgan, leaving the roving Cornwallis to pursue his helter-skelter, ill-fated march into Virginia? It is God who had raised up for us a powerful ally, a chosen army, and a naval force, who sent Rochambeau to fight side by side with Washington in the Battle of Yorktown." Washington writes, "To diffuse the general joy through every breast, the general orders divine service to be performed tomorrow in the several brigades. The commander-in-chief earnestly recommends troops not on duty should universally attend with that gratitude of heart which the recognition of such astonishing interposition of Providence demands." The next year, the Continental Congress, it's now called the Congress of the Confederation, they pass another day of prayer. They write, "It being the indispensable duty of all nations to offer up their supplication to Almighty God, the United States and Congress assembled do hereby recommend to the inhabitants of these states in general to observe the last of Thursday of November as a day of solemn thanksgiving to God for all his mercies." Well, they negotiate back and forth, and in September of 1783, have the Treaty of Paris that ends the Revolutionary War. And for those not familiar, the Treaty of Paris starts off in the name of the most holy and undivided Trinity, it having pleased divine providence and so forth. So the very treaty that ended the Revolutionary War starts off acknowledging the most holy and undivided Trinity. And an interesting quote from Ronald Reagan, he says, in 1775, the Continental Congress proclaimed the first National Day of Prayer. In 1783, the Treaty of Paris officially ended the long, weary Revolutionary War, during which a National Day of Prayer had been proclaimed every spring for 8 years. And now John Hancock, he is back to being the state governor of Massachusetts. And he says this, November 8th of 1783, just 2 months after the treaty with Paris, Treaty of Paris. He says, the citizens of these United States have every reason for praise and gratitude to God for their salvation. I do appoint the 11th of December as the day recommended by Congress to the states to be religiously observed as a day of thanksgiving and prayer, that all the people may then assemble to celebrate that he hath been pleased to continue to us the light of the blessed gospel, that we should offer up fervent supplications to cause pure religion and virtue to flourish and to fill the world with his glory. But anyway, I could go on and on, but these are all stories out of the book, Miracles in American History. Amazing stories of answered prayer in our past. And I go through the writing of the Declaration of Independence, and then the War of 1812, the Barbary Pirate Wars, you know, the Civil Wars, a cholera epidemic in 1849 when the President Zachary Taylor has a day of fasting and prayer. There's when Woodrow Wilson entered into World War One, he has a day of fasting and prayer. World War Two, FDR passes out Gideon's New Testament and Book of Psalms to all the soldiers in World War II. Just 70 years ago, a Democrat president is passing out New Testaments and Book of Psalms. You wonder what book would be passed out today. I mean, here we are, homosexualizing the military and telling them they have to perform gay marriages, you know. And then even when Apollo 13 was lost in space, right, when the oxygen tank exploded, Nixon had a day of prayer for the, for them. And but a fascinating overview of history and America and times of crises that we were in, and our leaders that had faith and courage, and for God's purposes, our country was spared. And it's important for us to remember these stories because we're facing some crises today, and we need men and women with faith and courage now.
Absolutely. Fascinating indeed. Don't forget, over this wonderful Independence Day celebration weekend, to go to AmericanMinute.com and sign up for your American Minute email every day from Bill Federer. Take a look at his book page. Miracles in American History is the number one bestseller on that list. There's a long, long list of other publications by Bill Federer. Thank you so much for that incredible retelling of American history on this Independence Day, Bill. I can't thank you enough for being on with us.
Well, thank you, and I'd love to be on any time, Lisa. You're doing a great work.
Thank you so much, and we'll talk again soon. Have a great Independence Day. Thank you so much.
Thank you. You too.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay, folks, we ran long again tonight, but I want to thank you for being with us. I hope you enjoy your 4th of July holiday. We'll be here next week on Missouri Grassroots Radio, Culture Vigilante, 7 p.m. Central Standard Time. Follow me on Facebook and Twitter, and look for Missouri Grassroots Coalition on Facebook and MissouriGrassrootsCoalition.org. Have a great weekend, folks. Be safe.
Missouri Grassroots Radio is brought to you by the Missouri Grassroots Coalition, a cooperative of independent Missouri groups whose aim is to restore constitutional government. Visit us at MissouriGrassrootsCoalition.org, check out our Facebook page, and follow us on Twitter. You can contact us anytime at info@MissouriGrassrootsCoalition.org. God bless and keep you till next time we meet.
Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here.
We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting.
No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.